Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, working to assure opportunities for successful employment for all people with disabilities. A skilled workforce for Florida's businesses. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. On the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The federal sequester starts hitting home in Florida. We'll see how it's impacting one of the state's National Guard units.
You know, it's not good. You know, you can't go in and cut a family's income by 20% over the next 3 months and it really build morale.
Also this week, is Florida's crackdown on prescription drug abuse also making life hard for people who have a legitimate need for those drugs?
It took 12 pharmacies to find one that would fill my orthopedic surgeon's lawful prescription for me.
We'll also look ahead to the 2014 Florida governor's race, talk about how the Sunshine State may deal with the demise of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, and learn the latest on a battle between a Florida family and an assisted living facility they say should be shut down forever. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Because of federal budget cuts, furloughs are causing Florida National Guard facilities to operate differently. Stan Jastrzebski visited a base this week where Guard higher-ups briefed the rank and file on what to expect, how to protect their money, and what delays will be considered acceptable with a four-day work week.
A few dozen vehicles transition through the Florida National Guard field maintenance shop in Tallahassee each month. On this day, Sergeant Ron Charleston is replacing a hydraulic cylinder on a six-wheeled troop transport. It's about a four-hour job, work the temporary technician likes, even if his job status is unsure, and sometimes leaves his clothes so soaked in sweat and transmission fluid, he says his wife makes him take them off as soon as he walks through the door. But Charleston now has fewer total hours each week to do that work after the federal sequester demanded the guard take Mondays off for 11 weeks this summer. So Charleston is looking for other work.
If I can find something permanent tomorrow, I'd be gone the day after tomorrow.
still losing 20% of your pay over the next few weeks. It's not going to be enjoyable.
So this week, military officials convened troops from across the panhandle to provide answers about how the shortened work weeks will affect the soldiers.
And it would tick me off if I didn't know the answer. Why do we continue to hire? All y'all are working in shops. We're hiring. You see the advertisements are out there. We're hiring technicians. I'm hiring temp techs. How can you be hiring temp techs and hiring techs and yet you're furloughing me? That's insane.
That's Lieutenant Colonel Marty Nichols, who's having to serve as an accountant and a counselor and in many other roles as he tries to make sense of how soldiers should steel themselves and their families against the hardship of the furloughs.
It's people. So, you know, you'll have some people that are going to look at this and, you know, they're going to manage their finances well. They're going to see, they're going to look at it, they're going to do the math, they're going to look at a 20% reduction, and they're going to understand what that's going to do. Unfortunately, there are individuals, there's just some people that are naturally going to wait a little bit longer. They're going to believe it's not going to happen.
But the furloughs are happening, and Major General James Tyer says it can only be a drag on morale.
You know, it's not good. You know, you can't go in and cut a family's income by 20% over the next 3 months, and it really build morale.
Tyer tried to buoy the troops' spirits by letting them know they will not be expected to produce the same quantity of work during the shortened work weeks, and said supervisors will not be docked in their evaluations if those under their command appear to do less. Back in the garage, Sergeant First Class St. Clair Sefik says he's insulated from that worry because he's judged on how good his repairs are, not on how many he completes. But he's already begun to see more vehicles sitting in the lot outside his garage, their maladies scrawled in white chalk on their windshields like poorly kept medical secrets. And if the National Guard is needed to go to any natural disasters between now and September, that wait list is just going to get longer.
If these storms do hit, then the vehicles they take out, if they're going to tear up. And then when they come back, then that's just going to build it even worse.
Is it particularly bad in a funny way to have these furloughs happen during a tropical storm season? Was it worse for Florida because of that?
Yeah, they probably could have picked a better date for Florida-wise because we are in the heart of hurricane season right now.
So you're just, at this point, you're just hoping for a calm season. That's going to help you out.
Yeah, it'd be real nice if these storms bypassed and didn't hit the state of Florida.
The furloughs were initially scheduled to last twice as long, 22 weeks versus 11. But for a force not easily intimidated responding to perilous weather or dangerous overseas war zones, the politics of the federal budget process may be among their scariest foes yet. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Stan Jastrzebski.
Another big story on the national news front of late has involved the federal government gathering information on U.S. citizens. Of course, state and local governments keep certain kinds of citizen information in databases as well, and there are worries that information may not be totally secure. For example, the ACLU of Florida wants law enforcement agencies to have warrants before asking state health officials for patient information housed in Florida's prescription drug database. This after the names of more than 3,000 Central Florida residents were released to prosecutors and defense attorneys as part of a probe into doctor shopping. As Lynn Hatter reports, the news is stirring privacy concerns and charges that Florida's efforts to crack down on prescription drug abuse may have gone too far.
Since Florida began cracking down on prescription drug abuse, the number of deaths caused by controlled substances has decreased. Halfway through 2013, there have been fewer than 400 deaths caused by such drugs, and that's on pace to meet levels not seen since at least 2007.
I will tell you, we are known as the Oxy Express, and that is not what we want our state to be known for, and that's not we are not going to be known for that.
That was Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi in 2011 after the number of overdoses peaked in 2010 at more than 1,500 deaths statewide. Florida was known as the pill mill capital, with lax rules governing the prescribing of such drugs. The legislature chipped in with tough new laws on what doctors could prescribe, regulations aimed at shuttering pain clinics, and a database that houses information on patients who take controlled substances. The database has been the most controversial part of the crackdown. The Florida Department of Health oversees the system, and doctors and pharmacists input information. Law enforcement can request information in the database from the Florida Department of Health, but the American Civil Liberties Union of Florida's Assistant Legal Director Maria Kayanen says the rules around searching the database need to be clarified.
They can use a wildcard search for aliases. They can use a sounds-like search. They can use a search that uses the first three letters of someone's last name. Searches like that, which encourage very broad fishing expeditions, could yield 3,300 names.
A federal probe into doctor shopping gave officials the names of 3,300 Volusia County residents. Those names were later turned over to defense attorneys, and Kayanen says the requests made to the department were too broad and didn't turn up much.
It yielded six prosecutions. Do the math. It's wrong.
But law enforcement officials like former Duval County Sheriff's Office investigator Lori Abramowitz say the ACLU's request is too cumbersome.
I don't have a problem with redacting other people's names that aren't involved in the investigation if that comes up. I mean, there are some, but like I said, having to get a subpoena or a search warrant to obtain that information would totally slow down the process and put us going backwards rather than forwards, in my opinion, because it is working. Doctor shopping cases are down, at least in Duval County. It is working.
Donna Ratliff heads the Fight for Pain Care Action Network, an advocacy group for chronic pain patients. She says the state's pill mill crackdown has caused the quality of care to decline.
Most people are undertreated now because doctors are afraid to write the right amounts of medications because they're in fear. And everything they write gets put into this database, and if it shows a doctor's writing large amounts or for people that legitimately need it, they're afraid, so they're just not going to write as many.
But Florida Pharmacy Association CEO Michael Jackson says much of the difficulty stems from increased demand for prescriptions after the state shut down and placed limits on dispensaries, including doctor's offices.
What we're dealing with now is we've had such a large run on many pharmacies in the state of Florida that it has somehow had an impact on supply.
A statement from the Florida Medical Association says the group disagrees with state requirements that doctors consult the database before prescribing the medications. But other doctor groups say their members have had more positive reactions to the database and say it's been instrumental in preventing doctor shopping. During the 2013 legislative session, Spring Hill Republican Representative Rob Schenck filed a bill to get rid of the database. The measure failed. GOP Representative Mike Fasano of Newport Richey, an early backer of the system, says while he believes there should be some changes to the database, it shouldn't be scrapped altogether.
There are some out there that want to do away with it because you know why? Because we've put them out of business and they've left the state of Florida. Let's not go back in time and allow them to come back into the state and start killing our young people once again.
And even pain management advocates like Donna Ratliff agree the database and other state efforts have been effective on cracking down on prescription drug abuse. They just want the state to find other ways to help legitimate patients get their needs met, too. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Join the conversation. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. Still to come on Capitol Report, as two opposing parties hope to one-up the other in choosing Florida's best gubernatorial ticket, some are already criticizing the governor for one of his most recent decisions.
It's been 120 days since the resignation of Lieutenant Governor Jennifer Carroll, and Rick Scott says now he's beginning the search for a replacement for Florida's second-ranking constitutional officer. That's outrageous.
The mother of a teen who lived at a troubled assisted living facility is taking her protest to the state capitol.
These facilities can be fined, lose their license, still appeal, and accept residents at the same time.
And if you smoke, that could snuff out your employment chances with some Florida cities. Florida's 2014 primary elections are a little more than a year away, and there's a striking lack of people at the top of each party's ticket. Governor Rick Scott has repeatedly delayed picking a running mate, and there's been no Democrat anointed as Scott's likely opponent. As Sasha Cordner reports, the process leading up to those decisions could be turning into a standoff between the parties.
With his 2014 re-election bid around the corner, Governor Rick Scott has been touring the state touting his accomplishments. But there's one thing missing, a running mate by his side. His former Lieutenant Governor Jennifer Carroll resigned in March after she was linked to a veterans charity investigated for being an alleged gambling ring. Now that Scott says he's begun the official search for his partner on next year's ballot, University of South Florida political science professor Susan McManus says political insiders may again be pondering the best way to craft a diverse ticket.
Some of them choose a running mate who is going to complement them with skills that they may not necessarily have, which, of course, Lieutenant Governor Carroll was selected because she had legislative experience and she put diversity on the ticket.
There is speculation that Scott may be vetting Miami GOP State Senator Anna Terry Flores, a Hispanic woman. Some even think Scott might reach across the aisle to Orange County School Superintendent Barbara Jenkins, an African-American Democrat. There's also former U.S. Senator George Lemieux and Panama City Republican Representative Jimmy Patronis, who recently stepped out of the race for current Senate President Don Gates' seat. Still, Scott is keeping tight-lipped about who's on his short list, but he says he's keeping an open mind.
The way we're going to go through this is let's look at the qualifications and let's find the best person. And that's what my plan is to do it. We're going to be doing that. So, I came in from outside politics. I'd never run for office before. And I think it's good to bring people in. It's good to bring people with different backgrounds.
Scott has not given a timetable for when he will make his choice, and that's left his opponents charging he's dragging his feet.
It's been 120 days since the resignation of Lieutenant Governor Jennifer Carroll, and Rick Scott says now he's beginning the search for a replacement for Florida's second-ranking constitutional officer. That's outrageous.
That's the Florida Democratic Party spokesman Joshua Karp, who says it's unfair to Floridians for the governor to take so long. Meanwhile, the Democrats may also be taking a long time in identifying a gubernatorial frontrunner. So far, the only well-known Democrat to throw her hat in the ring is former Senate Democratic Caucus leader Nan Rich. Other names thrown out as potential candidates are former Florida Chief Financial Officer Alex Sink, who ran against Scott in 2010, and former Governor Charlie Crist, a Republican-turned-Democrat. Neither has made any official announcements. USF political scientist Susan McManus says both parties are taking their time to decide because a number of factors must be weighed, including race and gender.
It's going to be very difficult in the future for just an all-white male ticket to be successful in a statewide race in Florida. And both parties are very aware of that.
And McManus adds waiting for either side to choose their candidates could lead to a standoff.
You know, the person that makes the decision first is at somewhat a disadvantage because the other side can counter and offset or maybe pick someone who can one-up even the governor's choice of a running mate on a particular issue or skill.
But the deadline is still far away. Governor Scott has until early September of next year to officially name his running mate. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
A state appeals court has, for the second time, allowed a South Florida assisted living facility for young adults with developmental disabilities to keep accepting clients. Health regulators have been trying to close the center for years. As Jessica Palumbo reports, members of one Pinellas County family protesting at the State House earlier this month say they don't want other families to endure what they have.
On a recent Monday morning, Roxana Jeffries and her son Matthew stand outside the Florida Capitol holding posters. They'd left their home in Clearwater at 3:30 that morning to drive to Tallahassee for a protest they advertised on Facebook. But by the time the appointed hour arrives, they're the only participants.
It's worth it. It's worth those that don't have a voice for them to know I'm here, and I'm going to keep fighting for them a better life.
Jeffrey's oldest son, Josh, is 19. He has Asperger's syndrome, a form of high-functioning autism. Until this spring, he lived at Hillendale, an assisted living facility in the Tampa area. But Jeffrey says she had to remove Josh because he was being mistreated.
He was physically abused, emotionally abused, mentally abused. He was attacked on several cases. I went to the administrator, didn't get anything. We couldn't get him to respond.
Hillendale is a 12-bedroom home catering to young adults with mental illness and developmental disorders. State records show a pattern of violence and abuse at the facility since it opened in 2005. That first year, the owners were temporarily prohibited from admitting new residents after an inspector with the Agency for Health Care Administration, or ACA, found they'd routinely admitted dangerous residents. Since then, documented incidents include the 2011 rape of a resident by a staffer. Another resident who had a history of running away was struck by a car and killed after she was left unsupervised and escaped. ACA finally revoked Hillendale's license this April, but it remains open and is accepting new residents while the owners appeal that decision. Jeffrey says that's a double standard.
If we abuse our children or the elderly, we're standing in front of a judge. We're in jail. We do not get our children back. These facilities can be fined, lose their license, still appeal, and accept residents at the same time.
Twice, healthcare regulators have asked judges to stop new admissions, but the court has denied those requests, most recently on July 2nd. Jeffrey says she's haunted by middle-of-the-night screaming phone calls from Josh's friends who are still at Hillendale and whom Josh thinks no one cares about. Hollywood Democratic State Senator Eleanor Sobel says many lawmakers are fighting to make things better, but they're up against legislative gridlock.
Nothing has gotten done in the last 3 years, despite the fact that the governor had a task force that recommended changes. The Senate had a study done. Miami-Dade had a grand jury report. And the Miami Herald had an investigated report neglected to death.
This year, Sobel sponsored a bill that would have made it more likely for problem facilities to close. The legislation would have required more training for workers and follow-up inspections for violators and created an online rating system like the state already has for nursing homes where clients' families could leave comments.
People would be able to pick and choose through the internet which would be the best for their loved one.
The bill passed out of the Senate unanimously but never made it to the House floor. Sobel says assisted living facility owner associations fought the bill, saying it created burdensome regulations. But she thinks if the state can weed out the bad apples, the state's 30,000 assisted living facilities will benefit from the boost in public confidence.
What kind of message are we sending if we cannot provide for them in a safe environment? I think it hurts us economically because we're not providing the best kind of facilities.
Assisted living facility administrators in Florida must have a high school diploma and take a 26-hour course followed by a written test. Jeffries, whose son lived at Hillendale, says she came to the Capitol to advocate for better staff training. She says she'll return with her posters until she feels someone has heard her. Lawyers for Hillendale and state regulators declined to comment, citing pending legal action. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Marriage equality got a major boost when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down major provisions in the Federal Defense of Marriage Act last month. But as Nick Evans reports, it's still unclear how married same-sex couples will access benefits if they live in states that don't recognize their union.
In 2008, Florida voters amended our Constitution, said that we are a traditional marriage state. Marriage is between a man and a woman. As governor of the state, all of
that's Florida Governor Rick Scott explaining the impact of the DOMA decision in Florida. For supporters of so-called traditional marriage, the Supreme Court's narrow ruling was a victory. John Stemberger of the Florida Family Policy Council says states should be allowed to define marriage for themselves.
Good news is that in Florida, our constitutional amendment, which defines marriage, still stands. So the court did respect states' rights, and it did not force this issue, allowing states to define marriage.
But this creates a problem for same-sex couples with out-of-state marriage licenses. Many federal agencies, including the IRS and the Social Security Administration, look to the state of residence to determine marriage validity. But Florida's Constitution doesn't just limit marriages to heterosexual couples. The amendment says any same-sex union treated like marriage cannot be recognized within the state.
States are still allowed, as a matter of federal law, to disallow or not to recognize same-sex marriages performed outside of their state.
That's Ariane Plasencia, a lawyer with the firm Carlton Fields. She says that's still true because Section 2 of the Defense of Marriage Act wasn't argued in the case the Supreme Court just decided. So even though the court has ruled all married couples are entitled to federal benefits, states are still allowed to write laws that don't recognize same-sex out-of-state marriages. Bill Rohr, another lawyer with Carlton Fields, says the solution may come in the form of new procedures for administering federal benefits.
It might be something as simple as, for purposes of determining whether or not a same-sex couple is validly married, the federal laws will refer to the state where the marriage was celebrated.
By making this change, states that choose not to recognize a marriage wouldn't be consulted in the first place. But Rohr cautions that still wouldn't grant those couples state marriage benefits. Orlando Democratic State Representative Joe Saunders says that could drive same-sex couples away from the state.
We have done nothing at the state level to ensure that gay and lesbian families are recognized, are protected. In fact, the only laws we really have on the books that acknowledge gay and lesbian families are ones that marginalize them and seek to protect people from them.
Rohr and Plasencia both recommend same-sex couples seek counsel for estate planning. Living wills and a declaration of healthcare surrogacy will help ensure one same-sex spouse is able to look after the other in the event of an emergency. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. There are many reasons to quit smoking. Here's just one more. Florida's capital city is now considering a ban on hiring smokers for city government jobs. Tallahassee would not be the first Florida town to put such a ban in place. Some city leaders say that would help them close a $5 million budget shortfall. But as Ryan Bank reports, it's not really clear if smoking bans save money.
Smoking cigarettes can lead to heart disease, hypertension, cancer, and depending upon where you live in Florida, unemployment. Tallahassee City Commissioner Scott Maddox says smokers present a higher health care cost to the city, and it's not fair for taxpayers to subsidize a bad habit.
If you smoke cigarettes, it's bad for you. It leads to cancer. It leads to lung cancer. It leads to heart disease. It's an elective choice that you have made. I don't think if you have made that choice, you ought to be eligible for hire at the city of Tallahassee.
But banning smokers from being hired presents a quandary. Should cities also consider banning people with chronic health conditions such as obesity? Tallahassee healthcare attorney John Buchanan says employers should only consider those types of bans if they can prove such conditions affect productivity.
Well, I think you'd have to look at job performance and have to have a causal relationship between the activity and the job and performance or the type of job that the potential employee is seeking.
But smoking does seem to affect performance. Recent studies show that smokers take more sick days than their non-smoking counterparts and have significantly higher health care costs. Tobacco-Free Florida's Shannon Hughes says added cost is significant.
Female smokers incur $17,500 more in lifetime medical expenses than non-smoking women. And male smokers incur $15,800 more in lifetime medical expenses than non-smoking men.
But according to a 2012 study by researchers at Leahy University, obesity in the U.S. contributes more to an employer's yearly health expenses than smoking. But Chris Lunny of Tallahassee's Rady Law Firm says because of the costs long known to be associated with smoking, bans have been upheld at the highest levels of the Florida judiciary.
Since 1995, the Florida Supreme Court looked at this issue and decided that municipalities can preclude smokers from, you know, their payroll and being employed by the cities.
Still, Lunny says other states haven't taken Florida's lead.
Well, there are currently 29 or so states that offer smokers' rights and would preclude employers from asking questions like that or stopping smokers from enrolling on their payroll and becoming employed. Florida is just not one.
Since the Florida Supreme Court's 1995 decision, the list of cities banning the hiring of smokers has grown. It now includes Atlantic Beach, Hollywood, and Hollandale Beach, among others. But Hollandale spokesman Radu Dodia says since the city adopted its ban in 1999, it hasn't realized any savings.
There was no studies done since then to kind of reflect whether this has had any kind of direct impact on our healthcare costs or has reduced any chronic smoking-related illnesses.
The city of North Miami, the plaintiff in the 1995 court case, rescinded its ban in 2003, even though the court ruled in the city's favor. Why? North Miami spokeswoman Pam Solomon says, like Hollandale, there wasn't a financial benefit.
We could no longer tell if it really made a difference on our claims. So since it had, we couldn't justify the financial impact of the non-smoking policy, she went ahead and rescinded that in order to help open up the applicant pool for our police officer recruitment.
For now, Florida cities are free to ban smokers from being hired. And some municipalities have done as Broward County did and upped health care premiums for smokers. As for Tallahassee, city commissioners say it's just one way the city might balance its budget. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Bank.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Bank, Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzebski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank intern Nick Evans, along with our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, committed to helping high school students with disabilities graduate and advance to jobs, post-secondary education, and a bright future. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. On the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.